Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Ken Wells, author of Gumbo Life, Tales from the Rue Bayou. We'll also hear from Scott Ellis, author of The Faubourg Marigny of New Orleans, A History. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ken Wells to The Reading Life. Ken grew up in Bayou Black with great memories of his mama's gumbo, the inspiration for the book we'll be talking about today, Gumbo Life, Tales from the Rue Bayou. His career as a writer began in Houma, and then he went on to 24 years at the Wall Street Journal. He's also written 5 Louisiana novels and that great nonfiction book, The Good Pirates of Forgotten Bayous, Fighting to Save a Way of Life After Hurricane Katrina. He's speaking to us today from his home in Chicago. How did you get there? Ken Wells, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, I wish I were in New Orleans because it's 15 degrees here. So
I bet.
But it is gumbo weather.
Yes, it is. Now, you have lived the good life. I forgot to mention that you're also the author of Travels with Barley, A Journey Through Beer Culture in America. So you've had the beer, and now it's time for the gumbo.
Yeah, I don't know what my next act will be. Maybe ice cream.
I don't know. I don't think so. Now, you begin, as most chroniclers of gumbo do, with your mama. So tell us about her and tell us how she made gumbo and, most of all, how you learned the hard way.
Well, my mom grew up speaking Cajun French. She was born in Thibodaux, Louisiana in 1926 and came from a big family of Tubuses. There are more Tubuses in Thibodaux than there are Smiths in Ohio.
Yep.
She had 7 siblings and, you know, learned to cook gumbo from her mama, who learned to cook it from her mama and so on. So we think that, you know, that even though no one wrote recipes down, the Tubes gumbo probably goes back to at least the middle 1800s or something like that. So, yeah, I grew up on Bayou Black eating my mama's gumbo and went away to graduate school in Missouri when I was 26 years old without having learned to cook my mama's gumbo. And, you know, I mistakenly thought Missouri was a place in the South. And, of course, this was 1975, and gumbo had not traveled yet. And people in Missouri thought gumbo was some version of voodoo. And so there was just, you know, there was no way to get gumbo, and I had not learned to cook it. So I was desperate. It was a cold, cold winter, and I was miserable without my chief comfort food. So I did something I'd never done in my life. I called my mother and I begged her over the phone to, you know, tell me how to make gumbo. And, you know, my mama said, "Ken, yeah, what's wrong with you? You know, I can't do that on the phone." Mama, I'm desperate. I'm desperate. So, you know, I dutifully took down the recipe, and then, you know, and then she said, "You know, you got to make that roux." And of course, I've since learned in my gumbo journeys that, you know, there is a lot of gumbo made without a roux, but in my mother's orbit of, you know, good Cajun Catholics, you know, roux's gumbo was blasphemy. I mean, you just, you know, you couldn't, if the gumbo didn't have a roux, it wasn't a gumbo. You couldn't call it a gumbo. Mm-hmm. So I say, "Well, Mom, walk me through this." And, you know, it didn't seem that hard, but I made this first gumbo and I so undercooked my roux that it basically looked like camel's cream of mushroom soup.
Ew.
And it was so bad that even my cat wouldn't eat it. So I threw the gumbo in the garbage and ordered in. I actually, you know, invited guests. I was so hubristic, you know, that I could do this, that I'd actually asked people to come over. So I threw the gumbo in the garbage and I ordered in pizza. And then that Christmas break, I drove home to my mama's house. I marched into her kitchen and said, "I'm ready. Please show me." And so she did. And we went through 2 gumbo making sessions together, and I can't tell you how happy I was getting back to what I call the state of misery, because it was still so cold in Missouri. And I could cook a gumbo. I mean, you know, it wasn't my mama's gumbo exactly. And I realized that the roux was only the really tricky part. And if you got the roux right, though, you had a really good chance of making a good gumbo. And, of course, since then, I've been mom's gumbo, but still not as good as hers.
Aw. Now, one of the things you bring home time and time again is that gumbo is social currency. It's the way we make ourselves at home in other cultures and the way we make folks from other cultures at home in ours.
When I watch people make gumbo, you know, after Katrina in New Orleans, I was there early with the Wall Street Journal, and of course, when the power started coming back on, people could cook and get gas. You know, everyone was cooking gumbo. And just to watch how lovingly and painstakingly people made their gumbo and how keen they were to share it and invite others to partake in it and how proud they were, you know, that this thing that had been sort of so lovingly passed down through the generations was still managing to make people feel great, you know, after all these decades and centuries. So I think there really is kind of a, you know, a rich tradition. And there's no other dish like it. I mean, we have other great dishes. You know, we have our coubions and our fricassees and all kinds of things. But still, you know, gumbo remains kind of the lingua franca food of our culture.
And I love the way you describe how Senator Alan Ellender and Marcel Bienvenu took gumbo to Washington, D.C.
Oh, man. You know, again, you know, Senator Ellender was from Montague, Louisiana, which is a little tiny Cajun hamlet south of Houma, you know, down in the swamps, marshes, salt marshes, about 30 miles below Houma. And, you know, he could stand living in Washington all those years because I think he served for 30 years. But he couldn't be there without his gumbo. And, again, you can't just cook gumbo for yourself, you know. I mean, no one does that. So, you know, he started cooking gumbo. And, you know, the list of you know, high-ranking people in Washington grew very long. And, you know, presidents and vice presidents and all manner of senators ate it. And, of course, the effervescent Marcel Bienvenu tells the story of being a congressional intern in the 70s. And same thing, you know, she's from St. Martinville. She, you know, she cooks her gumbo with a roux. There were three or four other Louisiana expats there. They start making gumbo, you know, in the, they have a little kitchen in the Capitol. The aroma of the gumbo goes wafting down the hall. Suddenly there are lines forming. You know, people go, what is this? How can anything smell this good?
I think they need it now. I really do.
Oh, my God. Just standing in line in the cap, you know, waiting for the bus in the rain one day, and a stretch limo pulls up, and who is it? It's Senator Hubert Humphrey offering them a ride. And they go, well, how do you know us? Well, you're the girls who cooked that gumbo, right? Would you invite me next time?
The girls with the gumbo. Now, it's such an individual art, and you travel around and you meet a lot of different people and hear about them. Like, there's this legendary cook, T-Man Gregoire, camp cook for Chris Senek.
Yep.
And Mr. Peg and Miss Bev, who are part of your extended family, who make pool dew gumbo.
Yes, you know, it's marvelous and magnificent, you know, the sort of the style that people bring to this dish. And I was, what really impressed me was just how many variations there are and how, you know, lovingly it's cooked. I've been in every state in the union except North Dakota, and I've traveled in, I think, 34 foreign countries. This dish is cooked so lovingly and with such reverence, and as you said earlier, you know, as something that everyone really wants to share with everyone else, and they take great pride in even in the sharing of it. So you can go all over the world, and the pool dew, which is, you know, the Cajun word for the, you know, the diminutive black bird we call the coot. I mean, Google coot and recipes, and the first 10,000 replies are, nobody really cooks or eats coot, right? You know, well, of course they do. You know, down there on the bayou south of Houma, you know, it's the pool dew, and it was and is revered. And the greatest story about pool dew gumbo, Mr. Pegg and Miss Bev Freemans, who were living in Houma but had a camp down in the marsh and were eating, you know, pool dew gumbo when they were, you know, their parents were cooking it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons is that, you know, Peg's parents were very poor and they didn't have much money, and you could buy pool dews for 10 cents a piece and put that in the gumbo. And even better, the Catholic Church had declared it to be seafood. So you could eat it on Friday.
What a boondoggle. What?
I mean, come on, where else would the Catholic Church get involved in declaring what is obviously a foul, you know,
right,
seafood. But you know, it's great. It's great. You know, it overcame the restrictions of eating meat on Friday.
And you can't write about gumbo without writing about the many versions served up in New Orleans. Can you even guess how many versions there are? Thousands and thousands.
Well, you know, so I did a, you know, I did Yelp search. And if you filter for either Cajun or Creole or hyphenated Cajun Creole or Creole Cajun, you get more than 300 restaurants. And all of them, I mean, I didn't search every menu, but I searched maybe 40 menus and, you know, some, well, like the gumbo shop, they have three separate gumbos.
Yeah.
You know? There are others, many other places have two, you know, gumbos. So, you know, New Orleans is awash in gumbo and probably unprecedented amounts. I think Bonton Cafe in the Central Business District was really the first, you know, kind of Cajun version mm-hmm. of gumbo being cooked in New Orleans. And that was like, you know, in the 70s, I think, when they got started. And you flash forward today, and it is everywhere. It is everywhere. And cooked with, you know, again, you know, just an astonishing amount of variety.
Well, and not only that, it's a huge business. This was one of my favorite chapters. You write about Chef John Fulce's Willy Wonka-like gumbo factory in a chapter called Moby Gumbo.
Yeah, I mean, I had no concept that someone was making commercial gumbo by the ton, mm-hmm. tons, and, until I, you know, began research on this book. And, you know, Chef Fulce, he might be our most famous gumbo historian as well. I mean, deep dive into it. And so he was the natural person. I wanted to interview him. And then when I started talking to his people about, you know, what he did there, you know, in Donaldsonville, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I said, well, can I get in and see the Skunk Works? And they said, well, I'm sure we can get you in there. And so I went in, you know, and sat through this, you know, entire session where they were cooking these 2.5-ton batches of gumbo.
And he had to invent the pots.
He had to invent the pots. He had to invent the roux cookers. I mean, there were no vessels capable of making roux by the time. And so, you know, he had to invent these things. And you know, the thing is, you go in, and it smells like your mama's house.
I know.
I mean, how could that be? I mean, how could anyone make gumbo by the ton, and it smells like your mama's house? But it does. It does.
His gumbo is really good, I think.
It really is good. You know, again, you know, I ran into a lot of gumbo snobs. You know, there are gumbo snobs.
Yeah.
There are New Orleans people who won't eat gumbo in Lafayette, and Lafayette people who won't eat gumbo in New Orleans because they don't know how to make that, you know?
I mean, yeah.
So you hear that all the time. Like, they don't know how to make that. You know, that's not the way my mama made it, so, you know, it can't be, you know, how could it be good? But the truth is, I mean, especially with the internet now and people moving about and you know, the mobility of our society, I mean, you know, there are a lot of experimental people who are going, and you're New Orleans, and you go to Lafayette, and you eat that dark roux gumbo, and then you come back to New Orleans, and you say, well, there's some variation of that, you know, with our traditional Creole gumbos might be interesting, and so you experiment, and suddenly you have something slightly different and new, but it's all doggone good. So.
Oh, this whole book sounds like a great time.
Yeah.
Oh, we've been talking with Ken Wells, whose wonderful new book is Gumbo Life, Tales from the Roux Bayou. You can meet him March 8th at the 2019 Jambalaya Writers Conference, sponsored by the Terrebonne Parish Library, and he'll also be appearing at the 2019 Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I'm so looking forward to getting down there.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Scott Ellis to The Reading Life. He's the author of Madame Vu Carree, The French Quarter in the 20th Century. And today we're talking about his new book, The Faubourg Marigny of New Orleans, A History. He's speaking to us today from his home in Panama City. Scott Ellis, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
Now, I was interested to see that you were born in our sister city, Orléans, in France, and you said it's only natural that New Orleans would capture your heart.
It does seem that way, yes.
And you began visiting in 1982 and lived here for a while in the 80s. So how did you decide to write these two histories?
Well, perhaps it's because when you live in New Orleans, you are saturated in two things. You're saturated in alcohol and you're saturated in history.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a definite synergy between those two. In my case, it really was the history more so, and I experienced a longing to know more about this, by American standards, very old city that I was living in, with its very idiosyncratic folkways and norms.
And what about Faubourg-Marigny in particular for this most recent book?
A great number of friends of mine, in fact, the majority of my friends in New Orleans, were participants in the revitalization of the Marigny in the 1970s and 80s, having been pushed or pulled out of the quarter, depending on how you look at it, by real estate prices and other things. And the Marigny really became my center of gravity in New Orleans after I moved away from the quarter in the mid-80s. When I would come back to New Orleans, the Marigny was where I'd go and where I will stay.
Well, Faubourg-Marigny has such a long and interesting history, starting with its namesake. Bernard de Marigny is one of those figures in Louisiana history who comes to us through this cloud of legends and colorful tales, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And actually, I would say from my research, most of those legends are not true, but he's still a fascinating person. I would say in New Orleans, the greatest sin you can commit is to be boring. And Bernard Marigny was never boring. Even to the end of his days, he was quite a character. But the truth about his life is fascinating enough.
So tell us about some of the myths you had to debunk.
Well, I guess the number one myth is that he had to sell off his plantation and turn it into the Faubourg-Marigny to pay gambling debts. There's no evidence of that. He was the wealthiest man in Louisiana when he inherited most of his father's estate at age 14. He was wealthy when the Marigny was created. He was wealthy afterwards. He was just being very shrewd. He had a lot of losses, financial losses in his life, but they weren't from gaming. They were from bad investments and natural disasters like crevasses. I would say that the second myth, which is a little more convoluted, is that he had some kind of a face-off with American investors who wanted to buy the majority of the Marigny, and he engineered some kind of shenanigans to turn them down. That is partly true. It's really kind of more convoluted, I think, than we would care to get into at this point. But a lot of the legends that have surrounded that are not true. He did pull a fast one, although exactly why I've never been able to figure out, because it really did not change his fortune one way or the other. He was still quite wealthy before and after this event.
Well, you also spent a lot of time tracking down the story of his house, of the Marigny Mansion.
Yes, I did. And that also was a very long and convoluted tale. There were actually two of them. There was the older one that his father and grandfather had built. Then there was another one that passed out of the family for a few years and then came back in. Right now, there is a power station, power substation down there where the mansion was. Maybe one day something nicer will go in there. I don't know. But whenever I pass by there, I like to think about Bernard standing on his gallery, looking out over his Faubourg.
It's funny how we fall in love with these vanished houses here. You know what I mean?
Right.
Now, there's another thing you do that is so interesting is the time you spend tracing the history of the Free People of Color in Marigny.
Yes, that is a group that has been almost forgotten, yet they were tremendously important, and their importance remains today. There were a number of them that were quite wealthy. They did not have all the privileges of white. They had to walk a fine line because some of them could be, as Solomon Northrop was, kidnapped and sold into slavery. They couldn't run for office. They couldn't sit on juries. But that did not prevent some of them from amassing huge fortunes. Some of them were also slave owners. But the nucleus of, I would say, the African-American intelligentsia after the Civil War was definitely the Free People of Color, and particularly the Couvent School, which at Touro and Dauphine, which today was been many different names. It's now, I believe it's still called the St. Louis School at this point. It has been renamed several times.
Right.
And that school, although that's not the original building, that school was set up as a school for children of free people of color and provided kind of a bridge between high school and college education for a lot of them. And a lot of those alumni eventually formed the group that got together and pushed the very famous Plessy versus Ferguson case forward.
Right. And you described the spot where the marker is, of course.
Yes. Yes, that's an area that has been so, it's quiet except when the trains go through there blowing their whistles at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Exactly.
It is good that there's a marker there. And also, of course, that part of Press Street has been renamed Homer Plessy, which I think is great because there hasn't been a cotton press there in a very long time.
That's right. Yeah. Now, there are so many colorful figures in this book. One of the ones that I was intrigued by, of course, as many New Orleanians are, was John Schwegman.
Yes, that's the John Schwegman that I knew when I lived in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say knew personally. But he was such a colorful personality that I felt like I knew him, and I felt like that he knew everybody. He was quite a character, and he really brought that mom-and-pop grocery into the 20th century and taught New Orleans how to make groceries. I have a lot of fond memories of the various Schwegmans.
Oh, we all do. Now, moving forward a little more into the future, another really important segment of the population in Marigny was the gay community, who made huge contributions to both the landscape and the culture. You know, I think of Faubourg Marigny Art and Books, which was for a long time the oldest gay bookstore in the country.
Yes, I knew the founder, Reverend Horner, quite well. The Marigny actually has had a gay and lesbian population for quite a while. Of course, there was not a lot of media attention or recognition about it for a long time, but as early as 1964, there were some male couples that were renovating houses down there, and then Gene and Lloyd came on the scene in the early 70s and began to evangelize, that's my term, began to evangelize the Marigny as a place that was desirable to live, especially for professors and students at UNO, because it's a straight shot down to Legion Field.
Right.
Also, for people of alternate lifestyles, I think the Marigny was a calmer place to live than the Quarter because there were, at that time, the Marigny was not a tourist destination, and the Marigny did not have as much of a police presence. So there was less social norming and less persecution, frankly, of people of alternate lifestyles in the Marigny. That was true also not merely for gays, but for people who found themselves in the counterculture as well.
Mm-hmm. So what is it you love about Faubourg Marigny? I mean, a writer doesn't devote this much time and energy and exhaustive research, I must say, to a topic, unless there's something that draws your heart as well. So what is the feeling you have for this place?
Well, like a lot of other people who were not born or raised in New Orleans, when I started coming to New Orleans in the early 80s, I had the very distinct feeling that I was coming home to my real home. And eventually those feelings really gelled and concentrated in the Marigny, and my feeling of familiarity with the Marigny, the fact that I've had so many friends over the who live there, still have a lot of friends who live there, still it's a walkable neighborhood, every building has a story, it just has a feeling of home to me, and in fact it's, I say New Orleans is my charging stand. I have to go to New Orleans and plug myself into the Marigny every so often.
Oh, amen to that. We've been talking with Scott Ellis. His new book is a wonderful celebration of a New Orleans neighborhood. It's called The Faubourg Marigny of New Orleans, A History. You can meet him at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival when he appears on a panel about New Orleans neighborhoods. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for the schedule. Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Really enjoyed it.
All right. Look forward to meeting you in March. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Phil Hoos signs Attucks, Oscar Robertson and the basketball team that awakened a city. Sunday, March 3rd at 2 at Octavia Books. Poet Amy Trussell will read at the Maple Leaf Bar, Sunday, March 3rd at 3 p.m. Poet Valentine Pierce presents a workshop on how to read and present your work, Saturday, March 9th at 2 at the In the Garden Writers Workshop at the Alvar Branch Library. That's at 913 Alvar Street. David Fulmer discusses and signs The Day Ends at Dawn, the seventh and final novel in his acclaimed St. Cyr series, Saturday, March 9th at 5 at Crescent City Books. David will sign books, give us his abbreviated writing workshop or speech shop, and read from that final novel. The Pirate Sally Faulkner Society presents Meet the Author with Thomas Mallon, author of Landfall, Maurice Ruffin, author of We Cast a Shadow, and Roger Kamenetz, author of Yonder, Sunday, March 10th from 2 to 4 at the Cabildo. Ken Wells discusses and signs Gumbo Life, Tales from the Rue Bayou, Monday, March 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold their big book sale March 14th through 17th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday from 10 to 8 and Sunday from noon to 5. Maxine Gordon appears with Fred Kasten to discuss and sign Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon, Thursday, March 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Listen for Fred Kasten's interview with Maxine on Jazz New Orleans on WWNO, Friday, March 8th between 8 and 10. And get ready for that big literary weekend in New Orleans, March 27th through 31st, when the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival takes place, along with the Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival. Some of the writers coming to town include Dorothy Allison, Jamie Attenberg, Brian Batt, Donna Brazile, Doug Brinkley, Maureen Corrigan, Michael Cunningham, Samantha Downing, Judy Gron, Garth Greenwell, Justin Philip Reed, Felice Picano, and Brian Washington. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net or SASFest.org for complete schedules. And coming up in Houma, the Terrebonne Parish Library hosts its 16th Jambalaya Writers Festival March 9th from 7:30 to 6 at the Terrebonne Parish Library, 1515 Library Drive in Houma. This event features New York Times bestselling author Beatrice Williams, Carolyn Brown, Elise Arden, Dacre Stoker, Nathaniel Rich, Laura Cayuette, Erica Spindler, Sheba Turk, and others. There will be a pre-festival event Friday, March 8th at 6 at the library featuring Ken Wells, author of Gumbo Life, Tales from the Rue Bayou. For tickets, go to mytpl.org. And coming up in Baton Rouge, Delta Mouth Literary Festival, a partnership with the Louisiana State University Department of English, the Southern Review, New Delta Review, and the English Graduate School Association, takes place April 5th through 7th at LSU. It's free and open to the public, and the lineup includes Joss Charles, Tia Clark, Jerrica Marchand, Megan McDowell, Carrie Messenger, Theory Mint, Dennis James Sweeney, and Jeannie Venosco. Check out deltamouth.com for the complete schedule. And a big shout out to Tulane University professor and novelist Lady Hubbard, who's been named the second Gulf South Writer in the Woods, sponsored by A Studio in the Woods and the New Orleans Center for the Gulf South. Hubbard will receive a stipend of $5,000, a six-week residency at Studio in the Woods over 18 months. Her first novel was the critically acclaimed The Talented Ribkins. During her residency, Hubbard will be revising her second novel, The Rib King. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. ¶¶